Hi there. Welcome back to Step by Step, a five-part series from Future Commerce. And in this series, we are walking you through everything that you need to know to launch and grow your successful retail business. In Step by Step Season 1, we're talking all about funding. And if you're jumping in midway through, I highly suggest that you go back and listen to this series from the very beginning. This is episode 4 of a five-part series, and today we're diving into the topic of private equity. Brian, who's up on deck today?
Today we have Jeremy Mieres from Lion Capital. Jeremy is an industry pro who built up Burberry's e-commerce practice and grew it from zero to one of the most prolific e-commerce practices in the world. I learned so much from Jeremy on this episode, and I'm so excited to hear about his insight into the world of private equity. I bet you're tired of hearing about venture capital. Time for a little private equity talk.
And what's interesting about private equity that I'm sure you'll learn from this episode is that it's actually a lot more like sunshine and rainbows than you might think. Every time I heard of private equity prior to this, I thought, oh, they're just going to come in and kick out the original leadership and dilute what a brand actually means. There's actually a lot of really interesting success stories that Jeremy dives into, and specifically those that he's worked with at Lion Capital. So I'm really excited for this interview. All right, sit back, relax, pull up a chair, get ready, because we're going to hear from Jeremy Mieres about everything you need to know in the world of private equity.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. Well, I'm going to date myself straight away. I've been doing digital, you know, since the early 2000s. So not a veteran quite, but certainly been around for long enough. I kind of got interested in all of this when I was in Hong Kong, and I became very close to the team that was building out Monster.com, which was sort of the early days of recruitment out in Hong Kong, and recognized the potential. And so when I got back to the UK, I was I really focused in building out my understanding of e-commerce as it was then, and digital marketing equally as it was then, before social media. And I started working in a company called Agent Provocateur, which was a high-end lingerie business in the UK. Quite small at the time, went through sort of meteoric growth in the midst of sort of Cool Britannia, and in the end was sold for a significant amount to a private equity company. Following that, I worked at Topshop, running Topshop.com for a brief spell before joining Burberry, where I started as the e-commerce manager for Europe, working a very small team of three people in an office on this lost mezzanine floor where the toilet sort of leaked through the roof, with an executive team on a floor that I didn't know where it was. And they didn't know what we did. We didn't know what they did. But, you know, we saw the 12 orders coming through on day one, and we built that business to 145 million globally over 8 years during the time I was there. So it was an exciting time. I can't take all the credit. There was a whole bunch of very bright people, and in particular, Angela Aaron's vision to really position digital and then e-commerce at sort of the forefront of the business strategy. And we did a number of really interesting initiatives, things like shopping directly from the runway, which we were the first to really execute, really building out omnichannel globally, which again, I think buy now, buy in store, ship to your house, buy online, pick up in store. These types of initiatives we were pioneering, certainly in the luxury space. And then more branded initiatives like Burberry Bespoke and Art of the Trench. So it was a time of exciting innovation, and I was, you know, very fortunate to be part of that. It led me then to a slight pivot, but kind of not really. Having done that 8 years at Burberry, in the end I was leading global e-commerce, so I said over sort of 150, 145 million. I decided it was time to leave. There'd been a lot of change. And I had the opportunity through a good friend and colleague of mine, a gentleman called William Kim, who had left to become the CEO of All Saints, which is a Lion Capital company. I had the opportunity to move across and work in the PE space and for a company called Lion Capital, as you nicely positioned at the beginning, you know, a very much consumer-focused PE firm, which, you know, at the time of inception was quite unique. Obviously, a number of people have moved into that space now. And my role was threefold, really. You know, one, and the majority of the time, really operating as a sort of a an expert or operating partner around digital technology, marketing, brand. So that's kind of what drew me to it. It was quite broad. It was an opportunity to really stretch myself into some areas where perhaps I didn't have as much experience, and then obviously bring a lot of my sort of the heartland of my experience to bear across a broad sector, a broad selection of sectors. So not just in luxury fashion, but we have, I mean, we do have fashion. So we have brands like All Saints, as I mentioned, brands like John Varvatos. Previously, we've been involved with Jimmy Choo and American Apparel. Currently, we have Alex and Annie as a minority investor. Over here in the beauty space, we have Perricone MD, which is a luxury skincare brand. We have Paige Denham over here in the LA. Lenny and Larry's a cookie, protein cookie, vegan health protein cookie out in LA again, which is doing very well. UK Grenade, protein bar in the UK. So it really spread across consumer, focused in on fashion, beauty, jewelry, and we have also got a background in hospitality and sort of fast casual dining. We owned Wagamama's at one point, so it's pretty broad, and it's given me a chance to really get involved in a number of different sectors. But as I say, operating partner predominantly, they're also helping on the deal side with the deal execs in diligence, ensuring that we are asking the right questions and assessing businesses in the right way. And projecting their growth and feeding into sort of the value creation plan that we put in place and work with founders on. And then third part is really just internally being sort of a center of excellence for the firm, but also for the portfolio. And doing things like webinars like this or podcasts like this. But also we have sort of a biannual summit where we get everybody together. I try to work across portfolio in what I coined the Lion Capital Digital Services, which is a sort of a network, a virtual network of consultants, vendors, partners who we sort of bring to bear across the portfolio and sort of leverage to ensure that we get the right services, the right cost, etc. So that's kind of what I do now. Is that enough of a brief introduction, or have I gone on too long?
That's amazing. Super interesting. So we've already had two different venture capital companies on the show to talk about how they're approaching their merchants and investments. I'm already hearing some very distinct differences between venture and private equity. This is a bit of an explainifier podcast, so right. Maybe we could start with just a really basic question. Tell us about what private equity is, and maybe just do a little bit of comparison to venture capital, just as a starting point for our listeners.
Okay, I'll try and keep it as simple as possible. Essentially, private equity, PE or private equity, is equity or shares representing ownership or an interest in a particular company, specifically that's not public. I think where this differs a little bit from VC is we require these companies to be a little bit more scale and to really be able to demonstrate a number of years of profitability. It gets hard for us and the sort of the models that we employ if that's not in place. And interestingly, today, particularly as you look at a lot of these direct-to-consumer brands, a lot of that we've been very interested in, that's kind of been part of the challenge that we've faced, even though they've seen hyper-growth. It's often over a short period of time, and more often they're not profitable. So we put that differently, if you like, it also gives founders a source of investment capital and quite a large source of investment capital. So again, if you are in, say, you've been through VC and you're still in that growth phase, but you really see that there's opportunity internationally or to extend into different product categories, but you need to get significant investment, then that's where we would help. Each investment varies in terms of size, dependent on the strategy of the firm and the size of the firm. We'll typically invest over 100 million in a business. We tend not to go much smaller than that. And ultimately, for private equity, the motivation is a pursuit of achieving a positive return on investment over a period of time. And typically, that's sort of 5 to 7 years that we would typically hold a company before either, you know, selling it to another private equity company, perhaps, or taking it public. So in a nutshell, that's PE. Where do we get our money from? Typically, our money is from large institutional investors. That's you know, things like pension funds, insurance companies, banks, or other sort of accredited investors, and those would be high net worth individuals. But unlike VC or sort of earlier stage, you're not going to have multiple investors. You'll have us, you know, typically will be, we particularly like to be majority investors. But typically some firms are so different. You may have a couple of minority investors. We were a minority in ABG at the time. So, I mean, that's sort of the 101 overview of private equity.
There's sort of a recurring theme that I'll muse on here, and I don't know if you should or can give a reaction to this, but I find it interesting over this series and learning about this for myself, how many different types of companies, both on the virtual or sorry, on the private equity and on the venture capital side, how many of them are actually funded by pension and collegiate and education, like systems of education, how many of those sort of large institutions have some kind of money invested in what is effectively betting on entrepreneurship being a growing portion of economic advantage in the United States. And I find that really encouraging. Some might find it scary. I find it very encouraging that if anyone's betting on anything today in 2019, it's that they're betting on American ingenuity and entrepreneurship. And I think there are worse things to take bets on
right.
in the world.
Right. I couldn't agree more. I think the short answer is a significant amount. Historically, PE firms have taken the bulk of their money from pension funds and LPs. And again, unlike venture capital, because as I mentioned earlier on, we aren't going to place a lot of super high risk bets on businesses that haven't proved themselves. We tend to be more conservative. Don't get me wrong, there's obviously still risk involved, but the process of diligence and the sort of the gates that need to be, that brands need to get through, our aim to give confidence and security to our investors so that, you know, when we come to present the case to our investment committee, who ultimately are, liable to go back to our investors, that they feel comfortable that they can sit in front of their investors and defend that investment.
So it's closer to like pulling out a loan than say like venture capital, which, you know, the people that go to venture capital would probably get left out of a bank. When someone comes to you, it's closer to applying for a very, very large loan. Obviously it's not a loan, but
yeah, in a way, and you're going to a bank that has got a credible track record and history that you trust, both in terms of the bank manager, the individuals that you're speaking to, but also again, their track record, right? So I mean, PE lives and dies on the success of prior funds and investments. And that's I think a very important part.
My sense is though that, you know, unlike a bank, my bank doesn't tend to get involved in the way that I run my business to make sure I can pay for my house. I get the sense that one of the value adds of private equity is that you can be very involved in the operations to help scale and grow your investment. Is that, how does that usually work?
I think that's a really interesting point. And, you know, it gets, I think the industry is constantly considering that and evolving in how they consider, how involved to be In short, it's broken. I mean, private equity does sort of split itself fairly down the middle and says, look, either we're going to be a passive investor or we're going to be an active investor. And I think increasingly, the active investor is becoming a more popular type of structure for a PE firm as it's got more, as it's become much, much more competitive. You know, there's a lot of money out there. There's a lot of access to money, but investments are becoming more expensive. There's a number of reasons for that. And the demands on PE are becoming higher with competition, the disruption that we're seeing coming through from digital and other areas. And so, you know, if we are going to secure the good deals, I think founders are looking to their investors saying, hey, you know, sure, great. You know, the investment is very welcome, and we need that. But in this ever increasingly complex environment that we're trying to trade in, if I can come to you and say, hey, I've got an operating team that can help you, you know, with your IT and technology, with your marketing and branding, with your digital supply chain, you know, retail execution. And you can point to a series of experts who have been there and done it before in, you know, high profile businesses, then I think that means a lot to businesses as they consider who to take investment from to grow their business.
You mentioned, you know, who to take it from. Maybe we can sort of start at when to take it from whom. At what point in the sort of the stage of the life cycle of a business, is a company like Lion Capital being engaged, and how do you usually, you know, how are you getting engaged? Are you, going to market trying to find these opportunities, or do people come to you? Give us a little bit of an insight in how that works.
So again, as I mentioned earlier, we're not VC, and PE and VC, have traditionally been very different, although there's sort of growth funds within PE, which are dropping down into sort of writing smaller checks and slightly smaller investments, and not always majorities either. But if I take our example, it's, you know, what I know best. I mean, we would typically look at businesses that are in sort of the growth stage of a life cycle. You get some PE firms that are looking at more distressed assets. We're not one of those. We generally need to see, as I said, a number of years of historical data and profitability before investing. But then we look at, say, you know, how can we maximize value of these brands? You know, is there an opportunity for us to take them into a new channel? You know, Page Denim, it would be a good example of that recently in our current fund, where, you know, they built a fantastic business largely through wholesale. And haven't really done much direct to consumer, either through physical retail or digital retail. So we saw an opportunity to really extend that and, you know, grow into that channel based on the strength of the brand and their supply chain and product and reputation. So there's new channels. There's also the opportunity to, I suppose, we want to look at them and say, can we extend into new, are there adjacent products that we could take this business into? So, Lenny and Larry's, in terms of their product, they have cookies, but, you know, we've already taken them into more snackable cookies. So rather than the big cookie that you see on the shelves, into small snackable cookies, you know, where there's a number of different products that are coming through the innovation pipeline there that are going to utilize sort of the core values of the business, but, you know, maybe move away from just a basic cookie. There's a lot more that we can do in that protein space. Yeah, it goes. I mean, that's a huge one for us. And again, I think a great example would be Jimmy Choo in the past, where, you know, not only did we blow it up in terms of shoes, but moved into bags. If I look at All Saints, you know, we've done a lot moving. We're great in leather, but it was all apparel. So we've launched shoes and bags, which has been great for us. So, you know, we're looking for businesses that have that potential to build out and to make them much larger entities. And of course, you know, another key thing, particularly here in the US, I think, which is certainly what I found very interesting coming over here, is that a lot of these brands, and these are big brands, but they're very, either sometimes even regional, but certainly national and haven't really grown internationally. And now that's not easy to do, but you know, one of the things that we bring is we have offices in London and in LA, here where I am. But we've grown businesses, we've built businesses in Europe. And so we've got a strong position here to our US businesses. Hey, you know, we can take you into Europe, we can take you into these markets, we have the relationships, the networks, whether it's licensing or whether it's direct, whatever it may be, we've been there and done it, and we've got depth of experience in doing that. So it's international experience is important. And then I think, you know, ultimately, if there's an opportunity, we have to see ultimately that there's a value plan in place that we can see a return on that investment. And, you know, smarter guys than me will be modeling that out to try and get us some sort of 2x return on that. And ultimately, that's kind of what we look for.
You mentioned category expansion. I had a little bit of an interesting spring this year. I shared a stage and emceed an event with Gary Vaynerchuk. Yeah. And so he gave me a signed copy of his book, Crushing It, which then I guess I was obligated to have to read. And but in the book, he was talking about Annie's, which Annie's is a consumer packaged goods brand here. I know they're available in the United States. I'm not sure what their international footprint is like, but they have, they're very famous for organic macaroni and cheese, where you might get a boxed macaroni and cheese, from like Kraft or somewhere else, but you may not love the ingredients that you read on the back of the label. And so if you're going to purchase, you know, that sort of food from that category, why wouldn't you purchase an organic variety? And it's interesting how they went from mac and cheese. It was never just about the mac and cheese. It's actually about organic comfort food, and how they talk about sort of this really strategic growth of category. And I find it interesting that that's one of the things that you reference as the kind of strategic approach to, you know, upscaling a business is, you know, how to do that, when to do that, and how to execute it well. Because I'm sure there are companies that are wildly successful with, you know, an evergreen product, but they don't know how to take the product and make it into a brand.
Absolutely. And Gary's as insightful as ever. I've met him a number of times. And he also puts a lot of value on culture and people. And I think we look for that in our brands in terms of leadership and management teams. I think that's very important. But your point in terms of products and services, often we look for a category or a brand within a category that is niche and then can be really blown out. Grenade, which is a UK-based protein bar, was a perfect example of that. I mean, the protein bar category itself is pretty advanced. But they had built this great story working with the British military and had real credibility in that small environment with something that actually tasted really great. But just had no awareness. And so our ability to scale that out has seen huge growth of that brand and that product because it had just a quality that was slightly different and an endorsement that was slightly different that we thought had a, you know, and that comes onto sort of the storytelling behind these brands that had a real story that we could tell. But, you know, you asked who, when we think about who we want to invest in. And I said, ultimately, at the end, it comes back to, can we deliver a return for investors? But I think it's also not only that product, you know, unique products and services, it's its reputation and its customer. And can increasingly we are, and we may come on to, you know, how we diligence, but increasingly we are looking at the company's own data and a lot more tools around, you know, really understanding how the customer affinity to that brand and loyalty to that brand. And, you know, you've got to be careful looking too historically on that, but you, with the current data, you can get build up a pretty interesting picture in terms of customer service and experience. And I think, you know, in this very competitive space, customer loyalty, brand loyalty is very, very, very important. And some of these, you know, growth brands have an immense, you know, really interesting customer and a lot of customers, but often they're not doing very much with that data. And so we see that there's a real opportunity to continue to build customer loyalty, but also build audience, much wider audiences based on our understanding of who their customer is and bringing in some of the tools that we have to bear on that.
I heard something kind of interesting. I feel like you've sort of been hinting at throughout this interview so far, which is you just said, you know, tools that we can bring to the table. And you mentioned Edge that you bring and like a number of other things that sort of implied to me that there's actually quite a bit of competition among the good deals. That's another thing I heard you say. You know, you're looking to go after good deals. There's a bunch of PE out there that's going after sort of distressed brands. But I don't think anyone that's listening is necessarily, or I mean, there may be some out there that are listening that are in that situation and do need advice there. But I really want to focus in on those brands that are in growth mode, the kinds of deals that you go after. I would imagine that there's quite a few companies, like when these companies decide that they are going to take capital, there's probably quite a bit of competition for being their investor, right, as they are a good brand. So maybe talk a little bit about, so are you going out and looking for companies to invest in, or is it, or are they looking for you? Which is happening more? Maybe you have some advice for our merchant listeners that are potentially on the edge of getting a PE. Do you have any good advice for them as they sort through this book of investors that they have to figure out, oh, wow, which one of these is the right fit for us? Any advice there?
Yeah. Deal flow is probably, definitely, one of the top three things that P talks about. It's a constant. We have to have deal flow. We have large funds of capital that we need to deploy, and if you can't get the deal flow, then you will fail. I think at the moment it's, and I know the last certainly last couple of years, probably if you talk to a real PE deal executive, you'll say more. It's becoming harder and harder to find and compete for good deals for mid-sized PE firms such as ourselves and a whole bunch of else. And there's been a proliferation of PE firms as well as there's become easier to raise capital. There's abundance of cash that's seems to be in the marketplace at the moment. What we're seeing are very high multiples and valuations at the moment. I mean, I think the average is in the region of 11 times. I mean, but so that's of EBITDA. So that's a significant valuation. And for consumer, I think it's slightly lower than that. So to get into, historically how you would do this, which is what we call an auction, which are, banks touting, banks going to PE firms and saying, hey, look, we have this deal, having a management book, doing investment presentations, then submitting, offers, first offers, going through that whole process of whittling down to somebody who is then, in a last one, two stage and invests a lot of money in diligence, becomes increasingly difficult for certainly for us trying to compete for the really good deals. So increasingly, and I think there's value in this. Increasingly, it becomes more about sourcing deals through other means, having really good execs who are, have fantastic relationships, and having a brand that attracts people to it versus having to, just have deal execs who are going through the motions, have relationships with the bankers. So it's the type of people you want, I think we call them rainmakers. You want people in your firm who have the relationships who can go out and bring in these deals without having to go through the mechanics of an auction. But also you have to have a reputation and a brand yourself that attracts people to you. And people come and seek you out, and that does happen as well, through word of mouth, predominantly through CEOs and founders. It's a small environment, as you know, and so we do see that. So, in short, we avoid auctions where we can. We rely on our really talented, business development guys, and our reputation as we look to bring in new deals. But you know, it's getting increasingly difficult. There's a lot of competition out there. And we are really finding that we have to pay closer attention to, you know, staying in our lane, really sort of maybe putting slightly bigger bets on, you know, sectors of businesses that we feel really confident that we can get comfort around because of our process. And, you know, paying attention to then actually, you know, really assessing what's required to be done. Again, like I said, a lot of that's through data. And then putting people like myself and others, you know, into the field early so that we can, you know, set the course, get the right buy-in, and, you know, move fast, which is ultimately, you know, where I think we feel that we add value versus sort of the big corporate entities.
You're saying you're the special sauce. You're the differentiator.
I'm the spicy sauce, right? That's what.
Yes. You're the thing that attracts people to. I mean, taking Burberry from you know nothing to $150 million in annual online sales is quite the pull. I think this is a huge differentiator for like the whole venture capital versus PE discussion as well. Like Philip said earlier. You're bringing so much to the table. When someone comes and gets PE, they're taking on a set of experience and a set of relationships and a you know a biannual conference. You know that they can go and you know find more resources. This is your value add is you're the best at what you do.
That's very kind of you to say that. I'll come onto the show anytime if you keep. you keep butting me up like that. I'm in. Sign me up. But you know, yeah. And I think you know when I started maybe 5 years ago for Lion as a sort of a digital focused operator, there was you could count on you know one hand. There's probably I think I knew them all. There was about three of us who were doing that type of role, and I think. And I know that that has changed dramatically. And I speak at some PE events and I certainly get a lot of attention. And a lot of people are trying to understand, you know, should they be bringing somebody, you know, like me in? I would caution that a little bit, you know, operating, is difficult. And I think, you know, really you need some scale within your operating function so that you can, you know, really add value. And I think, there are some firms that have really invested in building out operating teams. They tend to be the bigger firms. And there's others who will get a person or a couple of people in like us. And, you know, we add value and we help. And I'd like to think that we've benefited the brands and the portfolio significantly. But you still need to make a decision whether you are prepared to invest in capability internally and get the best, or whether you want to build, you know, take a more of a sort of a holding company approach and build out more of a sort of a center of operational excellence that covers some of the key criteria, whether that's technology, data, you know, social media, digital marketing, you know, you name it. Pick your department.
Do you think that there's having the notoriety and sort of the like you said, the sort of being a known entity in the world, sort of a destination, right? Maybe some validation to have Lion Capital take a stake in your company that you know that you are you know worth taking a bet on as a brand. Do you find yourselves ever in a position, or how do you prevent yourselves from being in a position where they expect you to be more active and that's not really your role? Or where they expect you to be more passive and you prefer the opposite. Can you tell me a little bit about how you manage the and how involved you are in the vision and execution for the brand?
You know, every brand is different. And that's the first thing to say. And I think it still surprises me that there is, you know, pushback in terms of what we can bring. And I understand that. I understand that. You know, people have built their businesses and have a lot of institutional knowledge in terms of how they've done that. But the reason, you know, really you bring in an investor such as Lion Capital, who is you know, openly an active investor, is to embrace what we offer. And, you know, and I think maybe, you know, it's the more traditional ways that we help, you know, that's kind of, you know, best practice in stuff like strategic planning or mm-hmm. financial management, you know, I think is embraced fairly easily. You know, there's a slight dichotomy in terms of where we can help in investment in infrastructure. You know, we kind of talk out both sides of our mouth sometimes there. We're kind of like, oh, are we going to do all this? But hang on a second, how are we going to pay for all of that? And, you know, again, that's why as I look at platforms, that's why somebody like Shopify is very interesting to PE, because there's not a massive outlay of capital required to put something in that you can really drive pretty effectively. But you know, I think to answer your question, we find that more often than not, if we've put the right team in place with the founder, and that there's a good relationship there, and there's a real coming together early on in terms of setting out what the value creation plan is, and getting, you know, really holding hands around that, it makes it, and introducing the sort of the operating team early in that process, and this is what the bigger PE firms tend to do, is then drive from the PE's perspective, having that board seat, you know, really building those relationships directly, because, you know, we know how to talk to and deal with retailers. Then we find that more often than not, we're welcomed in. That said, there's a story that was told to me by, you know, this old dude in PE when I started. He said one thing, I can just give you one piece of advice. He said, don't be a seagull. I said, what do you mean, don't be a seagull? He said, don't go in, don't fly in and shit all over everyone else and then fly out again. You've got to be a partner, and you've got to build relationships, and you've got to build trust. And that's no different to how you would operate within a company, a brand. It just happens to be cross-brand and cross-portfolio. And that's where things like these value adds, things, you know, getting everybody together, you know, and saying, hey, look, we've got a bunch of brands that are similar in many respects. You know, why don't I get out your way and create, you know, Slack channels and facilitate events for you to all, you know, learn from other people's mistakes and maybe share contacts, vendors, best practice, and that type of thing. Those types of things, rather than going in and saying, hey, okay, how much money have you made this month, tend to work much better in terms of building that trust and enabling us to have more of a input and perhaps do some cross-correcting along the way than it does to be too aggressive in terms of trying to, you know, set clear. I mean, don't get me wrong, we have certainly KPIs that we monitor and measure, but being too aggressive on that front.
I'm going to start telling you, Brian, from time to time, be like, hey, you're seagulling me right now. you need to back up.
It's a fairly scary picture for me in terms of what seagulling is.
that's phenomenal.
So I think what I hear you saying also is, like, you're to the point where you'll come in and you'll, like, actually, like, you'll help one of your portfolio brands set their vision and their strategic, you know, direction. You'll do strategic planning with them. Like, you'll get really, really, really hands-on. I mean, are you even to the point where you're, like, you know, replacing team members or making, you know, personnel decisions, or, you know,
they would never do that, Brian. That never happens in private equity.
No. There's no turnover at all. It depends. I mean, we of course need to be involved in the strategic planning and the budgeting, because ultimately we have to account for a bottom line. But I think, you know, we lighthearted about it, but it sort of raises an interesting conversation and brings to light some of the, you know, the challenges that founders can experience with PE and things that, you know, you know, can make the relationship a little bit more difficult. And ultimately, when you bring in PE, particularly if it's a majority as a founder, then you may, I mean, sometimes they've, you know, I can see, I'm not a founder, but I can see, we like to bring founders along with us, really. That's the first thing to say. It's very important to us. I mean, we tend to like to keep them invested and have something, you know, really to work for and play for and to get from the relationship. We aren't the type of firm that, you know, then just exits a founder straight away. We want to keep our founders. And as I said, we would like to keep management teams, and it's very important to us in assessing those management teams and assessing a business. If they've got a strong management team, that's a real tick in the box for us. But inevitably, we you know, one of the things, again, we can bring as a PE firm is we have an incredibly long list of very talented senior execs that we can call upon, a network that enables us to quickly bring in people as they are required. And so we will assess that with the founder. But the founder ultimately will, you know, does lose some management control and, you know, perhaps has a dilution of their ownership. And that can be difficult. And in terms of the strategic planning, you know, there'll be different definitions of value. I see this quite often. I mean, we can't get away from it. The PE view of value is, you know, we want to grow brands, but really it's about growing EBITDA and returning a good return on that investment. I've said more than once. But a founder's view on value may be more around brand value. I mean, certainly my experience with Burberry is, you know, Angela famously said that we're just custodians of this brand for a moment in time, and it's about building the brand over a lifetime. And so that's a slightly different approach. So, you know, we have to be very close. We have to be very clear about how we're delivering that value over that period of time. We have to be careful not to take that fully away from the founders, because that's why we bought the businesses. They know their brand, they know how to grow it, and just supplement that with some experience that we have, hopefully to ensure that everybody, you know, it's not without bumps in the road for sure, but to ensure that, you know, over the period of time when we reflect on it sort of year on year, and then over the end of the period, that we've seen the growth that we hoped and that the founders still in place, and that's still a value add as we come to sell the company.
Really well said. I've always felt like as well that over the lifetime of the growth of any company, you know, the one thing that is durable and lasts for the lifetime of the brand is the brand itself. And like any one person in an organization or team of people, you know, can be instrumental to the success and growth of the brand and at a point in its lifetime or its history. But you look at some brands that are you know, have stood the test of time and, you know, hundreds of years, even in the world, and still they remain, they can even outlast you and I. So I, you know, I think that it's super interesting when you talk about sort of the human side of where we fit into the equation and bringing something like a brand to life, and what the role of PE or any one person's role might be in you know, helping that survive or even thrive.
Right. I mean, that there has to be a brand there, and PE's not, we're not good at creating brands. And you know, it's interesting. We understand, again, what people look for in brands. We're all consumers, but it's beyond that. We've got real experience in understanding that. But particularly today, right, when there's so many more channels, there's so much more competition. As I said, you've got all of these, you know, amazing brands that are coming up and, you know, speaking the language of the new consumer, you know, are often purpose-driven and are really adept at using all these new channels. When we look at some of our brands, they have brands, but that's what they need to, you know, really become better at. So it's interpreting the brand, it's moving the brand away from a traditional way of expressing itself, to, you know, really sort of, you know, it's what we had to do at Burberry, and really sort of beginning to tell its story in a way that, you know, resonates and through channels where people are, you know, engaging with that content. And I think all brands are grappling with that, and it's hard to do it. I mean, look at All Saints; I think they've done it better than most, despite, you know, fashion being quite challenged in that for traditional brands, right? Because they don't have we're working hard on it. You don't have a real sustainable angle, which seems to be a good starting point for a lot of brands today. So where do you go? All Saints was really smartly tapped into sort of this sort of the zeitgeist of their customer. They even knew their customer really well. And every young man or woman, I think, goes through an All Saints period of their life where they're a little bit anti-establishment and, you know, want to stick the finger up to somebody or other. And so we know how to get those guys. It's how we continue to retain them as they grow older. It's important to us. So we use music for that. We use sort of street culture for that. And that's worked very well for us. But it's hard.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So I heard you say you're the stewards. You're sort of the Denethors waiting for the Aragorn. The way that you're protecting your, you know, these companies is to sort of like, you're seeing new types of channels open up. You're seeing barriers of entry to continue to fall. You're seeing up and coming brands that have, you know, that are building on new native channels. But what you're there for is to really help provide your brands, you know, a window into this and make sure that they have a strategy to compete and be ready for these up and coming new technologies and channels and methods of selling. Is that a fair point or a fair assessment?
You just summarized perfectly a very, very difficult thing. But also I think typically because we're investing in businesses that are larger and often have well established more traditional routes to market or have very solid product and supply chains that we can leverage those things to ensure that take John Varvatos for example. They've got a bunch of stores which we've opened up as do All Saints, but what we've done at John Perez has take advantage of that and build out really effective omni-channel strategies that are meaning that we're using our sales associates to help customers when they get onto chat or get on the phone, or we're creating experiences in store for when people come in and pick up their product, or we're surfacing what product we have in a particular store, so we're putting that to one side and so that when they come in and then we're giving some whiskey and enabling them to really immerse themselves into that. So we're taking advantage. So a lot of our brands have those sorts of traditional aspects that we then need to say, how do we use that to our advantage as well as trying to open up these new channels and considering how to work with people like, Amazon and third-party retailers and other marketplaces and try to understand, the direction of travel there for the consumer. And again, the advantage that I have and that some of us have at Lion is we're not in the, every day running around sort of hairs on fire, figuring out how to just make sales that day and what promotion we should run. We're able to sit back a little bit and really think about that more strategically and bring that to our CEOs and founders and be sort of sounding boards for them as they think about how to adopt that in their businesses.
I feel like this has been a masterclass. I feel like we should be paying you for this kind of information.
I thought this was a paid gig.
Oh, yeah. Check it's in the mail. Okay. There's a lot of money in podcasting. I don't know if you know that. Emerging markets at Lion Capital is the podcasting angle. You guys should check it out.
We're going deep on that. We're doing Pilates for podcasts. Yeah, Pilates for podcasters.
My pension's wrapped up in podcasting. Who knew?
Yeah.
this has been just wonderful. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for all of your time. This has just been such a wonderful time. I feel like this whole series has been a wonderful primer for all of us who are sort of understanding this point in history where access to capital seems to be growing. I guess I would leave our audience with a question to you, Jeremy, which is, is this a sort of a singular moment? Do you think that we're sort of the apex, or is this as hot as the economy gets, or do you think that we're just getting started in the world of retail and retail investment?
I think we're just getting started. I think it's going to continue. I think it's getting more complex. And I think in terms of the consumer's definitely facing its challenges right now. Nobody can deny that. And it's going through a ton of flux. But, you know, people aren't going to stop spending money. The routes to market are going to become incredibly more complex. Some of the innovation that's coming through is so exciting. Yes, the rate of the rate of change is just going to accelerate. I don't think anybody on this podcast or any of us would comfortably predict what the next 5-10 years looks like. But we know it's going to look very different to today. Mm. So you know, you need to work with people who, you know, are really thinking about what that looks like and aren't just thinking about how to go to market in the ways we've traditionally gone to market. So I think I'd leave you with that. I think it's, you know, yes, sure, you've got to, you know, we've all got monthly targets to hit, but, you know, if you're not taking time out to think about what your business looks like in 5-10 years time and find the right partners to work with to get there, and I don't mean, you know, innovation for innovation's sake and, you know, shiny objects. I mean, real tangible changes to the way that consumers are behaving, that technology is advancing. If you're not looking at that, then I think you're going to have a lot of trouble, you know, a few years down the road.
That is what the show is all about.
Yeah. As we usually say, you know, future commerce doesn't exist to try to predict the future, but to give you insights for you to be able to shape your own future. Right. And I think that we've done that here today. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Look forward to speaking to you guys again. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Step by Step by Future Commerce. If you found Step by Step valuable, or if you're looking for more information about funding your retail venture, drop us a line at hello@futurecommerce.fm. Remember, you can subscribe to Future Commerce wherever podcasts are found. And we'd like to extend a special thanks to Shopify Plus for making this series possible.
We also want you to be in the know for all the things that matter in your business. And Future Commerce Insiders is our weekly deep dive into those issues and concerns that matter to you as a founder or as a digital commerce professional. This weekly newsletter touches on topics like deepfakes, the attention economy, woke washing, surveillance capitalism, and sustainability. And you can get that every Wednesday at 2 p.m. by subscribing at futurecommerce.fm.